93.9 The Eagle, broadcasting live from the Zimmer Radio Group World Headquarters. This is the CEO Roundtable with Fred Perry. This city, it's my city, and I love it. Yeah, I love it. Get ready for interviews with movers and shakers from our community as we dive in for a deeper look inside Columbia. Now, here's your host, Fred Perry.
And welcome to the CEO Roundtable Show. Fred Perry, your host this weekend. Glad you have tuned in. We got a great show planned for you this weekend. We're going to take a little bit of a different approach, and we're going to talk about leadership and employee engagement and some of the things that are very important to the CEOs and business owners that are listening to this program. But we are visiting with Dr. Randall Widenar, who is the owner of VP Culture and organizational psychologist. Randall, good to have you in the program.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
Absolutely. You and I met recently, and we talked a lot about some of the things that you are doing with companies and some of the businesses you're consulting with. And I thought it would be really interesting to come in and share some of what you're talking about with our CEOs and business owners, and find out more about organizational psychology and what it makes to what it requires to keep a workforce engaged and feeling valued. And so tell our listeners a little bit about VP Culture. What is it?
Sure. It's a consulting firm, and we're focused on valuing people. That's what the VP stands for, than vice president.
Yeah.
So it's focusing on creating cultures of valued people. So we do that one leader at a time, and we focus on leaders, and we focus on giving them the one destination that they need to go to. Because oftentimes when you ask a leader, where are you leading people to?
Yeah.
Their jaws drop and they look at you and they don't know how to answer that question.
Really? Is there a right answer?
There is a right answer in my estimation.
Is it too early to give it in the program?
No. I mean, I've already given it away.
Yeah.
You're leading people to themselves, essentially. You're leading them to valuing themselves and others.
Okay.
Most people, you can communicate that to them. I can convince most people in any crowd in 10 minutes that's what they want more than anything else in the world.
Yeah.
But then further that, an excellent leader, a great leader, has to have the skills that can actually create that.
So, and that's a challenge. I mean, I think
that is the challenge.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how long you've been in this line of work and what was your training to get there?
Sure. You know, I've been in marketing for most of my life, for about 20 years. But towards the end of my career, I started looking into leadership and working in fields of psychology, both in the church and other places. And so about the past 8 years, I've been developing the curriculum for this. I first started looking at other curriculums from Gallup and other, you know, consulting firms that were out there, and I didn't find that they were really focused on the central thing.
Mm-hmm.
You could ask them that question, what's the one thing that your program leads to? And they'd look at you and go, I don't know.
Yeah.
These 20 nice things on the wall, these 26, these fives, these seven, how do you lead people to seven? You know, you need to be going to one destination.
Yeah.
And that's clarifying.
Kind of creating a common vision that everybody buys into and
just
clarifying the vision of where you're headed.
Yeah. And it's deeper than that. Mm. It gets into psychology. It gets into the heart of who we are as humans.
Yeah.
We are fundamentally wired for that type of connection.
Yeah. So where'd you grow up?
I grew up, you know, born in Chicago, you know, Cook County General Hospital on the south side in a Dutch community. So my family's all Dutch on both sides of my family.
Okay.
And my dad was, he worked for Arco Chemical Company. We moved all over the country. But between Chicago and Philadelphia, we mostly grew up. And I moved here to central Missouri because I had been living in cities in Europe for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I had little kids. And I thought, you know, I'd like them to have a little green grass underneath their toes before they hit adulthood.
Yeah.
So we landed here in rural Missouri and have been loving it here for 15 years. So that's my past, you know.
Yeah.
So it's a very different course than most people choose to end up in central Missouri, but that's how I ended up here.
Well, it's good for people from central Missouri to sort of hear just how good we have it when people who have lived in other cities and other parts of the world, they don't realize that most of what we take for granted is just sort of the quality of life that we have here.
It really is. I mean, yeah. My children have been in European cities and American cities, suburbia, and they're choosing to move back to central Missouri because of the lifestyle. So
yeah,
I concur. Yeah, there's something good that we have here that we should always be grateful for.
You spent some time in Greece, living in Greece. Mm-hmm. Tell us about mm-hmm. why you were there and what was that experience like?
Sure. It was like Hemingway said, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. You know, I studied there, you know, at the foot of the Parthenon mm-hmm. in neoclassical buildings. I was studying art at the time.
Wow.
You know, so what a place to do that. It was kind of heady. But at the same time, I was working with faith-based organizations, mm-hmm. Doing faith-based work. And that was part of my story, is that I was with these organizations and we didn't know how to do the culture thing, the mm-hmm. us thing together, even though, you know, we're people of principled values, we're doing things of high purpose, like feeding the poor and evangelization, and we still didn't seem to get the people thing right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was troubling.
Yeah. Are the basic ingredients of leadership and culture, are they the same across the world, or is it different in Europe versus what it might be here in the Midwest?
No, it's universal. Uh-huh. You know, these things are wired into who we are as humanity, as human beings. You know, we're wired with a certain thing that we're always attuned to, and it's down to our very molecules in our body, in our brains, that wire us this way. So it's not just, you know, you need to pick something that works for each individual. That's kind of what you hear on the internet, is like, find your thing, find mm-hmm. your truth, find the thing that, you know, that's going to motivate you for the rest of your life. And you know, that's not the thing.
Yeah.
It's something deeper.
Important question. What was your favorite thing to eat in Greece?
Oh, gyros.
Really?
Oh, okay. Man.
All right.
A good gyro on that.
Much different than the gyros we get here?
It's much different.
Yeah. Really? Okay.
Yeah.
What's different about them? Is it the meat? Is it the seasonings? Well, what's different?
Well, like everything in Greece is... if food in Europe is just a different culture.
Mm-hmm.
They will not tolerate anything that's not fresh. Like, you give a Greek a grape in April, and they're like, "What is this?"
Oh,
because they come. Every Greek knows that they mature and are ripe in August.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's when they want them.
And when you eat a Greek grape in August, it's just mind blowing.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
They use all fresh ingredients, and they intentionally cook in front of you so that you see everything that they do.
Yeah, I remember, it seems like the restaurants where you used to get the best gyros in town are no longer, and I don't know, I'm probably using the wrong words, but you know how they sort of slice the shawarma?
Yeah.
Am I saying that right? Or shawarma?
I don't know what they call it.
Yeah. But anyway, but you know, now it's kind of like this prepackaged like bacon. You know what I mean?
And yeah. So, in Greece, they never use the minced meat stuff because they don't trust it.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, they cook in front of you because nobody trusts each other. So if you're putting minced meat, there's probably some filler in there that you shouldn't be eating.
Yeah.
So you see that they're cutting real meat in front of you. You know, what's completely different. It's never minced meat.
way off subject, but something I'm very interested in.
Very important to obviously discuss.
That's
yours,
right.
You know.
So I want to talk a little bit about, we talk a lot about culture, corporate culture, mm-hmm. In this society. What are people really talking about when they mention that a culture, an organization's culture is good or bad? What are the things they're referring to?
Sure. On the one hand, I think most people have no idea what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. it's a hard thing to define.
Yeah.
So I try to keep it simple. I call it an emotional current within an organization. Hmm. So if you can imagine, a current is something that we're all kind of familiar with, particularly here in Missouri. I talk about our float trips. Nobody goes on a, "Hey, I'm going to paddle up the river" trip.
Right. Yeah.
Because it would be a lot of work, you know. Whereas when you're flowing in the current, you almost don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. You are moved along in a direction, and everyone is moving in the same direction. Mm. So, and I call it an emotional current because emotions are the things that help us to value everything. That's the differentiator. That's what makes us feel like this is good.
Yeah.
So essentially you have groups of people all moving together in the same place, doing the same behaviors and having the same values and thinking that the same things are valuable. Mm. So it moves us as groups of people in directions. And that becomes difficult for people to understand. But that's one of the benefits of me being and having lived in other countries, is that I have seen so many different cultures, and I've seen what's similar and what's different. And so you can kind of step out of your own culture and see it from a third eye perspective.
Yeah. So what percentage of that recipe of a good culture is leadership? How important of a factor is leadership?
Yeah. Gallup would say it's about 70%.
Wow.
You know, a leader, people leave leaders, they don't leave companies.
Yeah.
You know, you're always going to leave your direct supervisor. You know, that person is either going to make your life miserable or wonderful.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, I'm the last year of the baby boomers, and there's a part of me that sort of thinks, and, you know, I was a small business owner for 30 years, and there's a part of me that thinks, yeah, just show up at 8 o'clock and do your job and go home. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, but you really can't get away with that anymore. There are greater expectations on behalf of the employee or from the employee.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not a matter. Just come do your job and don't worry about all this stuff. So that's pretty antiquated thinking these days, I would guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think that with the current employment tightness, mm-hmm. people have choices.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember just any job you got, you were grateful for.
Yeah.
And you stuck with it.
Yeah.
You know, particularly like my grandparents who came out of the Great Depression. It's like, man, you have food on your table.
Yeah.
Be grateful.
Yeah.
You have a job. Be super grateful.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas now that's not quite enough, you know, and people have choices. And I think sometimes those choices have made things more confusing for kids.
Yeah.
And the younger generation.
Yeah. Yeah. What is a kid these days? What's the age group we're talking about?
I don't know. The Gen Zers, you know, the people that are coming out of college and coming straight into the workforce. You know,
yeah.
They're new to the workforce.
Yeah.
They don't know what to expect.
Yeah. I found myself calling a 40-year-old a kid the other day.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, man, I am really getting old.
Yeah. So. You start looking at the NFL players and you're like, oh, look at those kids.
Yeah. That's right. When you look at the things that typically motivate employees or make them feel good about or valued in the job that they're doing, is there a common thread? Is there a common ingredient in a culture that typically always works?
Yeah. So I use this thing called the eternity question, because when I ask your left brain, would you do this?
Yeah.
Your left brain starts calculating.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, I think that much money, I'd do that.
Mm-hmm.
Or if it was that fun, I'd do it.
Yeah.
But the right brain knows better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so what I do is I create this question that the right brain responds to. It's called the eternity question. Mm. So it goes like this. If you could take one thing from this world and I open up a sci-fi portal into eternity, you have to take that one thing into that world,
mm-hmm.
and it has to satisfy you forever. What do you take?
Hmm.
And so I offer people what they usually think about in jobs. You want money?
Yeah.
But that's all you get is money. It's got to have that. You know, you can buy anything you want on Amazon all day long.
Yeah.
Or you can have something that's enjoyable. So pick a sport, pick an activity that you love to do. You get to do that one thing for all eternity.
Mm.
Or something purposeful.
Yeah.
You know, something like you want to write that book that you know, do something really purposeful. You get to do that one activity for all eternity. Or I give you, you could be surrounded by those who care and value you for all eternity.
Mm.
What would you choose?
Yeah. How often is that the first answer? I mean, you have to kind of feed them that answer, don't you?
I mean, I do kind of.
It's not something that people recognize that they need.
It's amazing, though. But once I speak to groups all over the United States, you know, I'm talking from like welders to CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And when I give them the first three, that you can see their brows getting furrowed and like, oh, that wouldn't work. That wouldn't work. And then suddenly you give them number four and they're like, that's it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take them a nanosecond to raise their hands, and it's universal.
Yeah.
Everyone knows that would work.
Yeah. Do younger people feel that way? I mean, does a 22-year-old feel that way in the same way that a 52-year-old does?
I think so.
Okay.
You know, it's like I said, it's universal. I never get anyone saying, sometimes people will come back to me, well, you only gave me four answers. I'm like, well, give me the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're stumped and they can't say anything else. And it's like, no, that one is it.
Yeah.
You know, so it always comes back to that.
So do you see any differences from generation to generation in terms of the way that they view work and the way that they desire to be valued?
I don't see differences in valuing.
Mm-hmm.
I see differences in their relationship to work. Like we discussed earlier, I think the older generations have more perspective,
mm-hmm.
and they will unfortunately maybe resign to things a little bit more, and older people tend to be a little bit less dopaminergic. They're less driven. They're not going to try to create something new, whereas the young people are still in that full, like, oh, I can make it. I can change the world. I can do, you know.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that there's a story that I saw somebody who is 75 years old stocking shelves at the last at the last hour of a of their shift in Walmart.
Yeah.
And I asked him, why are you doing this? He goes, you know, you just have to serve somebody.
Oh, and like, interesting.
And then I saw at that same Walmart, I see the 15-year-old who's checking me out. I'm like, do you like your job? He goes, no, I hate my job. Mm. And blah, 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 complaining.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're going to have a long life to go.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Well, I think anybody who has run a business or managed employees, the idea to stock shelves at Walmart probably sounds very appealing. You know what I mean? In some respects. So, because this is how I'm going to make my living. There's a lot of knowns and certainties involved in this, and it's a rather black and white world. So we are visiting with Randall Widener, who is an organizational psychologist with a company called VP Culture based here in New Missouri. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the sciences behind culture and leadership. All of that and more coming up on the CEO Roundtable. I'm Fred Perry. You're listening to 93.9 The Eagle.
You can talk about the pit, barbecue.
This is the CEO Roundtable with Fred Perry on 93.9 The Eagle.
And welcome back to the CEO Roundtable. Fred Perry, your host this weekend. We are visiting with Randall Widener, who is the owner of a company called VP Culture. And they are, Randall is an organizational psychologist. What kind of education do you have to get to become an organizational psychologist?
Well, it's a, you called me a doctor earlier. I'm actually, I just have a master's degree in organizational psychology, but it's a degree that's focused primarily on the relationship of our mental capabilities and mental faculties in relationship to organizations and work.
Hmm.
So it's the psychology of us working.
Yeah.
To put it, to boil it down into the simplest term.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So there seems to be, I don't know, maybe I'm just seeing it the wrong way, but I have this sense that there is a large portion of the population that feels very disengaged or maybe disenchanted with their current occupations. For a big part of my career, I loved my work. You know what I mean? Until I had to manage people, you know what I mean? But I really loved what I was doing, and whether it was on the radio or it was publishing magazines or even in politics. But it seems like there's a large chunk of the population that just really seems disengaged. Is that an accurate sense?
Yeah. Gallup has statistics that say about 70% of people are disengaged in the work. And so there's about 30% who seem to have it intuitively worked out as to why they're working and what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, you know, like me and you, there can be things that get us very engaged and motivated for a long time. And it could be what I call dopaminergic. Like you want to get to that goal. You want to get to that end. Very entrepreneurial people are motivated a lot of times, but that is not always what lasts. It's that eternity question again. Eventually you're going to come to a point in crisis. That's why you get a lot of midlife crises where we're like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
What does this mean?
Yeah.
Why am I selling these widgets? Who cares?
How did I get here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So 70%, that's a pretty shocking number to me. What does it mean to value someone? I mean, when you actually, how do you express that? I mean, what could you say to somebody or do for somebody that would make them feel valued in the workforce? Give us an example.
Yeah, so that's the $24,000 question. Mm-hmm. You know, I came to the point of, that's the singular destination that we need to go. Mm-hmm. And then I scratched my head and said, well, why do we, you know, if I can, like in 5 minutes, I can get people to agree that that's what we want. Everybody goes, yes, that's what we want.
Yeah.
But yet then people don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an ancient Greek saying that you don't rise to the level of your good intentions. You fall to the level of your training.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if I were to put you in an F-35, you might really like that.
Yeah.
You might really want to fly it.
Mm-hmm.
But if I don't train you for 3 years, 4 years, you're going to press that button and fall into the water.
Right.
So you need to train. And leadership is that way. And there are some things that we'll get to probably that are skills that your great leaders have.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to have certain skills where I think, you know, I look at people, we're unique as human beings, is that we can think about the past as human beings, the present and the future. So we need to value people in those three sort of temporal domains. You know, like how do you value me as I come in from my past?
Mm.
And that to me is personality science. That's what I bring from my past. You can predict how I'm going to react already if you know that about me, if you know my personality. In the present is about emotional engagement. That's where we're communicating with what I call our first language, a soul language. You and I are talking with English words, but we're really communicating values. You know, do you value me? Do I value you? Through our emotional connection.
Yeah.
And then third is future values. Like there are, like the laws of the universe, there are values. There are six values that are called experiential values that people need to know and understand and explore. And if they don't know them, it's like they don't understand gravity and the magnetic force of the universe. And they're in relationships. If you don't know what's going on, like one of those is trust. Without trust, you cannot lead anyone.
Yeah.
And so if you don't understand the intricacies of that, you're not going to be able to create that. And people will give up hope of following a leader that they don't trust.
Yeah, you often hear that trust is sort of the new currency. That's really, what are some of the other six?
I would call there's three foundational ones that are like not energetic, they're calming. So it's trust, harmony, and then peace. If you can bring an employee or any person that you have a relationship all the way to peace, that means I can stand in your presence and I don't expect anything bad to happen.
Yeah.
The next three are energetic. That's what we use in work. And we usually just try to skip to these. And that's wisdom, nobility, where we're doing sacrificial things for others, and then joy. So you can finally get to the point where you enjoy your work.
Yeah.
If you're having peace and joy, you know that your employees and the people that you were with you're functioning in those values.
So what would you say to people out in our listening audience who are probably rolling their eyes as they hear this and they're saying, oh, come on, give me a break. Just show up and do your job. You know, based on an earlier answer, this is just the new reality, right? I mean, if you want to keep employees and if you want to keep them engaged and you want to keep them productive, these are things that you've got to start thinking about. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. The world has changed in that people are not going to spend 40 years in a job.
Yeah.
You know, partly with the employment circumstances post-COVID even, you know, things radically changed where people now have a choice. They can go down the street in 2 seconds. There's so much demand for labor here that you have to engage with people. So it's calling the bluff of the employer.
Yeah.
Because you can no longer be a sloppy employer. You can no longer just like, skip over that. They'll come anyway.
Yeah.
And so the tables have turned. And now we actually have to show up and actually be able to communicate why they should stay.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, it's really putting the onus on refining leadership.
Yeah.
If you don't know what that one thing is as a leader that we communicated earlier of valuing people, you're not going to lead people to themselves. They're not going to want to stay.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Most radar culture didn't really even show up on anybody's radar locally, I don't think. 10, 15 years ago, we had a local startup company called Veterans United that came in. It was a startup and they rapidly grew. And at one point, they got up to almost 6,000 employees in this community. And, you know, people couldn't figure out why they were losing their employees and it was a common complaint. Sure, Veterans United is fine, but they've stolen all my employees. And then it was kind of a wake up call for a lot of people to say, well, what are they doing over there that makes people want to work for them? And, you know, they still put that kind of energy and effort into, being a great place to work. So it's kind of one of those things where, I guess really just affirmation that, hey, if you want to grow your company, if you want to grow your workforce, you're going to have to focus a lot on culture.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Just the fact that you're talking about VU as being an employer of choice.
Yeah.
You know, that's indicative of employees have choices.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of power now.
Yeah.
And so, but the thing is, bottom line, people will work for, people want to live in a place where they feel valued.
Yeah.
And so if you can create that within your organization, that's very hard. Like when you get 6,000 people, you could be a CEO with all sorts of intentionality and goodwill, but it's not going to be you that implements that.
Yeah.
It's going to be those, you know, 4,500 leaders that you have within your organization.
When you think about, you know, I don't know the exact years of Generation Z. Do you happen to know the birth years?
Oh, gosh.
It doesn't really matter, but I think that it's 20s and 30s, I would guess, you know, and one of the things that I have noticed in my very limited exposure to younger employees is that they sort of come in, and the word entitlement is fairly negative, but they really want to, you know, like when you and I started our careers, I mean, we had to work for everything that we got. I mean, we had to scratch and claw our ways to the top. And, you know, whether it was we were looking for senior, if we didn't have seniority or we didn't have title, we really just had to get along and go along. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? We really didn't have a lot of say. But it seems like to me that the people in Generation Z sort of come into the workforce and they really want to have equal standing among their peers. I mean, among everybody in the company. Is that a wrong read, or is that just part of this psychological need that people have?
I think education has created that, and mm-hmm. we're kind of rewarding everything within that generation without having to do a whole lot of merit work. Mm-hmm. However, I always, as a leader, the buck stops with you. Mm-hmm. If you're not telling them why they should stay, and if you're not leading them to the great place, that's on you.
Yeah.
We can try to foist it off on another generation, mm-hmm. but it's on us.
Yeah.
We're the older generations. We should know. And that was my thing. When I was in my 20s, I was confronted with a 50-year-old manager who made my life miserable mm-hmm. and made me want to despair of ever working, mm-hmm. you know, in my 20s, my first major job. Why? You know, I don't ever want that to happen.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of part of my story is like, I don't ever want that to happen to another 20-year-old. Mm-hmm.
Was your manager oblivious to the fact that he was making your life heck?
I think he was partially conscious, but, you know, there's a lot of, you know, self-deception, like, oh, he should just buck up and get, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This is, everyone just should just know how to do this.
And
there was an assumption.
And I think that's because that's the way we had to do it. And so the expectation is that, well, that's the way we were treated when we were, you know, new in the workforce. And so, but it's like anything else. I mean, the world around us just keeps changing, and you have to be adaptable and, you know, adaptative, whatever the word is. But, you know, it's not, it's very confusing for a lot of people who have operated under one set of rules of engagement to all of a sudden understand or come to the conclusion, I've got to change the way I manage people. I mean, that's a real eye opener.
Yeah. And to me, it's just been clarifying that there was always a good way to manage people.
Ah.
The great leaders were always doing this. Mm-hmm. A great leader, you don't follow them. You follow where they're looking.
Yeah. Yeah.
You follow like, oh, you're going in that direction.
Yeah.
And it's to a good thing.
Yeah.
And so that's why even people who are gone like MLK, we keep following them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you use an acronym, and we're a little short on time here, but you use an acronym called OCEAN, and those are the big five factors. What is the story behind the acronym OCEAN?
So that relates to personality science,
okay.
Which is like if you come into the scene. So if one of those 20-year-olds comes into the scene, and I know their personality, mm-hmm. so OCEAN represents the five factors of their personality, and if I know what those are, I can predict how they're going to behave. I can predict what job they're going to like. And I can predict, like, a lot of times you'll go into a situation and somebody will go, you'll say, hey, we're going to have new software. And three of the guys will go, yay. And the other three will be terrified.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, what just happened here?
Yeah.
And it's two different personalities.
So let's see how well I took notes the last time you and I met. Okay. So O is for openness.
Openness.
Open to new ideas from your employees. C is for
conscientiousness.
Conscientiousness. And I can't read my writing here.
But extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism.
Okay.
Are the four.
Okay. Remaining. And then E is extroversion, correct?
Correct.
Which is how you position your emotions and assertiveness.
Yeah.
Okay. And then agreeableness is the A.
Yeah. Agreeableness. People are either, that's politeness.
You follow the rules.
And also compassion.
Okay. All right. And then N is a fun one. Neuroticism.
Neuroticism. It's from the Greek nevro, which is means nerve. And these people are the people that can perceive danger more acutely than others.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, that can't be.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's, you know, I'm glad my wife has it, but not me. But she probably wishes I had a little bit more of it. So, you know, it helps you to, like, my daughter's really high in it, and they're both therapists. And so somebody can walk in the room, and they can almost vibe them out immediately.
Yeah. Wow, two therapists in one family. That's got to be an interesting holiday.
Yeah, we have those different conversations, but definitely the neuroticism helps you. It's difficult because you feel the danger. You mm-hmm. don't just sense it.
Yeah.
So they often deal with a lot of difficult emotions, but they're also very wise. Because they can tell other people, like, that relationship you're in is probably not a good one.
Yeah, yeah. You know? When we come back from this break, we want to talk about some of the sciences that are behind leadership and engagement, personality sciences, emotional sciences, value sciences, and cultural sciences. And so we'll talk about those when we come back. And basically, what can a leader do towards becoming the best version of himself and in leading other people? All of that and more is coming up with Randall Widener, who is an organizational psychologist with VP Culture, based here in Mid-Missouri. All of that and more is coming up on the CEO Roundtable. You're listening to 93.9 The Eagle.
This is the CEO Roundtable with Fred Perry on 93.9 The Eagle.
And welcome back to the CEO Roundtable. This is Fred Perry hosting this weekend. I want to say a special hello to everybody this morning who is making their way to the Como Christian Men's Conference, which starts at 8:30 this morning. And we'll be at the crossing of almost 1,400 guys from all around Mid-Missouri are getting together today. It's going to be a great day. We have some great speakers coming into Columbia, and should be a pretty powerful day. So those of you listening, you're going to see me in a few minutes and say, hey, I was just listening to you on the radio. So I am looking forward to our day together. So thank you. We are visiting with Randall Widener, who is an organizational psychologist and the owner of a company, a consulting firm called VP Culture. And so basically, Randall, you will go in to a company as a consultant and take a look at culture, interview employees, interview leadership, try to get a feel for sort of the current situation.
Uh-huh.
Typically, what does your work look like with a company?
Sure. So we can do some diagnostics ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
We use a test that basically engages with people's emotional levels as how they're responding to work, called the Utrecht Workforce Engagement Survey. It's another mm-hmm. European test.
Yeah.
And then we basically... We have four workshops and a year-round curriculum that will basically teach people this one thing and the three skills that they need to learn in order to do that. So, so that by the end of it, they not only know where to lead people, but how to lead people. Like you were saying, you got to know both of those skills.
Yeah. Interesting. People talk a lot about serotonin. How important, what's the relevance of serotonin in this conversation?
Yeah, good question. So you'll hear a lot of people talk about dopamine on motivational factors mm-hmm. on the internet. It's all about dopamine. And yes, you do need that, but here's the deal. Dopamine leads you to short-term success, short-term goals.
Mm.
So, and then once you get that goal, it goes down. So I always ask guys, the guys get this one, like, if I gave you one new truck, that went an 80,000 new truck, would you be happy?
Yeah.
I said, if I gave you 1,000, would you be happy for the 1,000th truck? They'd be like, I wouldn't care.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they know that your dopamine goes down with each new hit, you need more.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times we lead towards that. And all of our leadership processes are kind of developed around that, like set goals, give people incentives.
Yeah.
But they don't realize is that the brain downregulates. And that's why you have 70% of those people kind of just letting go.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's not enough new incentives for them to keep engaging in that pathway.
Mm-hmm.
And so they kind of despair and just sort of like, ho-hum, it's work.
Yeah.
I let go.
Well, right around the pandemic, there was a term that was, I'm going to butcher it here, but that was bantied around by a lot of the national media, but, you know, sort of the quiet quitting.
Yeah.
You know, people would check out, they would leave their jobs without their employers knowing that they had lost their left their jobs.
Or sit at their desk and checked out on their phones.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just that's symptomatic that we're trying to engage them on the dopamine pathway.
Did that have anything to do with the pandemic? Or was it just a coincidence?
The pandemic made it possible that they didn't feel threatened. Like, you're going to fire me? I'll go down the street and somebody else will hire me in 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think that's what the pandemic opened up. So, you know, But the contrast is with serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
Serotonin is what gets released in our brain when we feel valued.
Yeah.
And then this thing, this neurochemical changes everything. It changes the way your body functions.
Mm-hmm.
It changes the way the neurons react to each other. It even changes your DNA.
Yeah.
So, and it starts to make you feel euphoric. It makes you feel healthy and changes your immune system and changes your energy level, your pain threshold. Everything changes when you feel valued.
Can you order this online?
You can't. And, okay. And that's what's funny is like you can take dopaminergic drugs. It's called cocaine and methamphetamines.
Wow.
And you can see what happens to people who take those.
Yeah.
There's never enough and they take it till they die.
Yeah. Interesting.
In fact, a rat in a cage, they'll give them a cocaine lever to put and they'll self-administer that until they die.
Wow.
You put a bunch of friends of him, little rat friends in that cage with him, he won't take a drop of it.
Wow.
Because the serotonin will release all of those chemicals in his brain so he doesn't need it.
So is there something that we can do to trigger the release of serotonin? I mean, what are the things that trigger that?
Yeah, so like I was saying earlier, we need to treat people, you know, you need to feel known and understood.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from if I treat you from your personality that we were just discussing earlier, the ocean. If I treat, if I know that you're not high in openness, you're going to hate that new computer program.
Yeah.
And the guy next to you is going to love it. So I'm going to partner you guys together and like, you know, Fred's going to hate this, but you're going to love this.
Yeah.
So work together. But you know what? Fred is really good at sticking to something because he's less open than you.
Mm-hmm.
So once you're done learning it, you'll be on to the next thing. And Fred will be following the process along.
Steady Freddy. Yeah.
Faithfully.
Yeah.
So I can, you know, I can. And then once I've dialed you in like that, you feel, oh, this guy gets me.
And that's when the serotonin gets released.
That's when serotonin gets released. That's one of the things. And then the other thing is that emotional language. If we can, you know, so much of our lives and so many situations, like we had a disappointment. If we can do that together as leader, studies by Google and by Harvard researchers show that if we can have like an emotionally safe place where you can be upset about something as a leader, but not crush everybody with your emotions, and that we can share that emotional reality together in a safe way, that makes the number one factor for team success.
Wow.
According to Google and Harvard researchers.
Yeah, interesting.
You know,
let's talk about some of the different sciences. Tell me the difference between a personality science and an emotional science.
Sure. So personality science deals with, you know, the past that you bring in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So personality science is something that is critical for leaders to have as a skill. So it deals with at least those five words. And so you need to learn that vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it opens up doors. Like I can sit down at a table as a leader and go, you know, Fred, you're really good at this. I'm not good at this.
Are you talking about the ocean? Is that what you're talking about?
Okay. Like in the open.
Yeah.
Or like the agreeableness is another one. So
okay. A
highly agreeable person is going to be a bad salesperson because they're going to give away the farm.
Right.
You know, whereas like a person low in agreeable is a great negotiator.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you don't want him to be customer service.
Yeah. So what's behind the emotional science then?
So emotional science is kind of tricky because it's a language we don't always understand.
Mm-hmm.
It is, emotions happen faster in our brain, about 100 times faster than our rational thought.
Hmm.
So what people don't realize is that you can't control emotions. You can only perceive and react to them well.
Hmm.
So you can't tell them, oh, I need to stop that. In fact, the more you try to stop an emotional reaction, the more gas you throw onto it and make it worse.
Yeah.
So the wise leader needs to understand that, both in how they're reacting and how the other person does. And once they can do that dance, that interaction to that whole language of emotions, which is our primary language, we learn it before, like your grandson will learn that before he learns to speak English.
Yeah.
And it's the primary language we don't know we're speaking all day long. So the primary problem that most leaders have is neglect. They give zero emotional signals to their employees.
Hmm.
And so the employee's left guessing, and that's threatening and terrifying.
And why is it? Is there a fear on that leader's part that if I show too much, if I reveal too much, it's going to be used against me?
Yeah, that's part of it. It's like it's difficult. If they're afraid, they'll try to hide that. And if they're upset, they'll try to hide that. So it's easier for them just to go, I'll just disengage.
Yeah.
Rather than staying in the game and engaging tactfully and appropriately
within
the workforce.
Yeah. Good. All right, let's talk about value science. What's behind that?
Sure. Value science is something that's greatly misunderstood, I think. So what fuels burnout more than anything else is this hope of like, I have no future in this. You know, when I was 20 years old with that 50-year-old, he wasn't engaging with me on the level of trust. Mm-hmm. He was just saying, hey, let's do work. And I didn't have his trust because he wouldn't listen to me. He wouldn't engage with me. And so I felt there's no trust here.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't really speak. He's not really candid with me with what's going on. Mm-hmm. He's not consistent. He'll make promises to me and then not keep them.
Yeah.
You know, so it's
and this isn't a faith-based organization, correct?
This wasn't a faith-based organization. Yeah. But, you know, it's usually people don't say, here's my promise, I'm going to break it.
Yeah.
They say, here's my promise. And then, oh, I had all these other priorities that were more important than the thing that I told you I said I would do.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like, oh, I'm doing all these virtuous things. But when you make a promise, that's a value you need to keep. And when we don't understand that as leaders, we're breaking the fundamental realities of relational connection. And so I didn't want a future with him. Yeah. And it was actually terrifying as a 20-year-old. It's like, if this is the way it is, that's a terrifying future.
Yeah.
And so you burn out and you disengage.
It's, you know, there used to be a very popular term, you know, your word is your bond or the importance of keeping promises. It seems like to me that is, there's less of an emphasis on that as a rule in society. Do you sense that, or is that just something that's unique to certain people?
Yeah. I think it's hard to quantify, but I definitely think we're really good as human beings of making up excuses for ourselves.
Yeah.
So when we do something that's inconsistent with our own values, we make stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I had another appointment that was more important. Oh, yeah. And when that might work on an occasion, but when it's a pattern, you just like, I don't trust you.
Yeah.
You know, you tell me to do things and then you say, have it by 2. And then you don't even show up at 2.
Yeah.
You know, so I, because I was such a go-getter, I realized I was doing this to people, you know, and so it being very convicting that I start living this
way. So what's behind culture science?
Culture science. So there are some mechanics and some best practices that you just need to understand, like the fact that we talked about leadership, that it's built around leaders, that it's built around teams, that human beings naturally form in around teams of 5. That's why like every military has fire squads that are about 5 to 7 people, because you can't think of more than 5 to 7 people. That's why our phone numbers are 7 digits long.
Wow.
So 5 to 7 people with a leader. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of science behind that. There's a lot of science about hierarchies, how a great leader has great levels of serotonin in their body, and they actually can engage in a virtuous circle with their team. And when they give to their team, then their team gives back to them. And the serotonin raises in all of that group, and they actually have more energy and are more engaged.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a positive cycle. So that's part of the thing. You have to have leaders, you have to have teams, and you have to dedicate time to actually talking about these cultural elements. And so many businesses just say, we don't have time. And it actually results in 1 day of productivity lost per week.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you don't engage in cultural discussions.
So we have about a minute left here. I was wanting to hear from you real quick about what are some of the warning signs that maybe things may be off in your company, that if I'm a CEO or a business owner listening, what are some of the warning signs or red flags that there may be a culture problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. So people leaving. Number one, if you see people leaving and you're saying, hey, how come people aren't, don't blame it on the economy.
Yeah.
Blame it on your leadership.
Okay.
You know, take ownership of it.
People leave jobs because of leaders, not because of the jobs. Yeah.
And the leaders that don't know how to do culture, don't know how to do valuing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
Yeah.
That is Randall Widener, who is an organizational psychologist with VP Culture. How can they get a hold of your, how can they find out more about your company?
Yeah, you can go to vpculture.com and learn more about our company.
Okay. Valuing people, vp.com. Randall Widener, organizational psychologist. Thank you for joining us. A very interesting conversation.
Thanks,
appreciate you being
thanks
here.
Thanks for having me. I so appreciate it.
Folks, we'll be back next weekend with another edition of the CEO Roundtable. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. This is Fred Perry. You're listening to 93.9 The East. This city is my city, and I love it. Yeah, I love it.